This is iBasics 101, Episode 2, Eye Anatomy.
In a world without good eye education, a beacon of hope is born. That beacon is iTalk Radio.
Welcome to iBasics 101. This is an audio program dedicated to teaching you about the eye and ocular disease. No matter if you are a student, a practicing doctor, or just a curious person wanting to learn more about the eye, we can all learn through thoughtful discussion. My name is Dr. Timothy Root. I am a general ophthalmologist and cataract surgeon. You can find this show at italkradio.com. If you have questions or comments about today's discussion, visit the show notes directly at ibasics101.com and just look for episode 2. Today's topic is eye anatomy, specifically the anatomy of the eyeball itself. We're not going to cover things like the orbit, the bone, eyelid anatomy, all that stuff around the eye, as I think this much anatomy in one session would be overwhelming to hear all at once. So we're going to focus on the eyeball itself. Now, anatomy can be somewhat challenging. In fact, this is another topic that I struggled with during medical school. And that's because anatomy is kind of like a language. Just like Spanish, German, French, you need to build a fundamental building blocks before you can actually start to get the big picture and put together complete sentences and thoughts. And without learning the relevance of real-life diseases, such as glaucoma and retinal detachment, it's really hard to memorize the underlying anatomy first. In fact, when I first learned this material, it was back in medical school in the late 90s, and I learned most of my knowledge looking at a Netter Atlas. That's the color atlas that most medical students used, at least back then they did. And I had to borrow a skull model from a friend because I couldn't really afford my own. And, of course, during gross anatomy class itself. And that's because the internet wasn't in existence yet. Yahoo was still the dominant search engine, and there weren't a lot of medical education sites. Certainly there wasn't a YouTube, and everyone was streaming awful videos using the Real Player codec, and there really wasn't a great anatomy website around for teaching this kind of material. Our anatomy professors were trying, though. In fact, I had a couple of highly progressive forward-thinking anatomy professors in medical school. One of them produced a digital book of anatomy, but he gave it to us on floppy disks, which wasn't terrible, but it was kind of dense and unintuitive, and it didn't really work for me. I had another anatomy professor who was experimenting with creating 3D objects that could be spun. This was back in sort of the mid-90s. Apple came out with a QuickTime VR image format. It was an image format for creating panoramas, but it was also useful for taking pictures of objects at different angles and turning them into a movie that you could pan left and right and spin objects around. And I remember my anatomy professor created basically a photo series of pictures of the pelvis, which is another one of those areas which is kind of hard to visualize. And this is one of the first things that really piqued my interest in the possibilities of new media, computers, online streaming, video, as an education format. Because I personally found traditional ways of learning anatomy, especially gross anatomy, was really disgusting. I really, really did not enjoy gross anatomy, and is really unhelpful for some systems, such as small organs like the kidney and the eye. Gross anatomy does not teach you much about that. In fact, I remember my first day of gross anatomy. I guess it wasn't my first day. It was the first day that we'd actually looked at the face and the eyeballs themselves, and we would unwrap these cadavers and unwrap their face with gauze. And the eye struck me as just the grossest thing in the world I've ever seen, because in cadavers, sometimes the eyes will sort of deflate. And so I took off the wrappings and I saw this horrible image of a dead person with their eyes sunken in. It was the grossest thing ever. And I didn't learn a single thing about the eye ophthalmology, eye anatomy with that experience. But the good news is that things are better now. It's much easier to learn stuff like this. Technology has vastly changed. YouTube is now out, and you can do a search on any type of eye anatomy, and you'll find lots of material. There's 3D models you can download wirelessly now to your iPad and learn anatomy from the comfort of your couch. And it makes you wonder if gross anatomy is really going to be necessary down the road. But that brings us to this episode. I've already created several anatomy videos, which you can find online, but today we're going to use the spoken word audio to learn this anatomy, and I hope you find this interesting. And it gets even better than that, because eye anatomy, compared to the anatomy of other parts of the body, is pretty straightforward, at least in my opinion. Anatomy is also a pretty stable field. Everything you learn through this audio and when you study anatomy is relatively stable for decades to come. It's very rare to discover new body parts, and this material will hopefully be applicable 40, 50 years from now, which you can't say with other subspecialties of the eye. The treatment for glaucoma, cataracts, and especially refractive surgery like LASIK has dramatically changes very quickly, and most of the stuff you learn now may not be relevant a couple of decades from now, but not so with anatomy, so this is useful information that will hopefully be evergreen and last for a long time. There are several ways to approach the study of anatomy. One approach is a systemic approach, basically look at the musculature of a body or the eye, the nervous system, the circulatory system, and piece things together that way. I've never really liked the systemic approach, but another approach is the location approach. Where are things at in location to others? And that's actually not that bad when it comes to the eye. My favorite approach to studying, though, is the disease approach, how things relate to ocular diseases that we actually treat and actually see on a day-to-day basis. Unfortunately, there's so much eye disease that we could cover that I don't want to overwhelm you, so I'm just going to mix things up a bit, and this will be a somewhat rambling discourse, but we'll review pertinent anatomy in future episodes as they relate to eye diseases that we're studying at that time. So don't worry too much about the fine detail today. This is more of a brief overview of the eye itself. Now, when we're talking about the eye, we're talking about the eyeball. But no self-respecting eye doctor ever calls the eye the eyeball. It's not a ball. They consider it a globe. So we're talking about the globe, which is really just the eyeball itself. I don't really have a strong preference. But let's talk about the globe. And with the exception of the brain, the eye, the eyeball, the globe is probably the most complex organ in the body. It has both a high-level sensory component with over 100 million rods and cones. There's clear crystalline focusing structures that can focus photons of light. There's muscles that are both voluntary and involuntary that control the eye to do all this stuff. And it's probably, well, it is the most powerful sensory organ in the body. In fact, the eye collects so much sensory information that a third of the brain is devoted to processing all that information to construct a 3D world in our brain so we can interact with our environment. And all of this is in a small space about 1 inch in diameter called the globe, and we've got two of them, so hooray, right? The eye has been considered so complex and marvelous a organ that Charles Darwin himself, in his book Origin of Species, confessed that the eye is such a marvelous structure that it is difficult to imagine such a thing evolving through evolution. The eye has been a central argument in creationism versus evolutionary debate for some time. But our purpose is not to argue for or against evolution, but to discuss the anatomy of this little organ, because it's pretty neat. At the most basic level, the eye can be compared to a camera, or a digital camera. And like all cameras, there are lenses in the front and film in the back. And when it comes to the lenses, we're talking about the cornea, the clear structure that makes the front of our eye, the lens inside of our eye, the retina in the back of the eye is the film. And finally, there's an optic nerve, which is like a transmission wire that sends the signals from the eyeball back to the brain. The outer wall of the eye is called the sclera. It's a tough tissue that forms the white of the eye. It's made of collagen, type 2 if you're interested in typing, but it gives the eye its outer integrity and supplies an insertion point for muscles that attach to the eye to help move the eye. The sclera itself is only about 1 millimeter thick at its thickest. And it actually gets pretty thin, about a third that at the insertion point of the eye muscle. So anywhere from a millimeter to a one-third of a millimeter, which I know sounds pretty small, but when we're talking about a structure that's only 24 millimeters across, it's not that bad. It's relatively tough. The sclera is continuous in the back of the eyeball with the external sheath of the optic nerve. So it goes to the form of the outer optic nerve. Where it flows forward to the front of the eye, it forms the clear cornea. Now, the cornea is probably one of the most studied areas of the eye because it's so important, and it's one of the areas that's very easy to visualize in the eye office. It's primarily made of collagen, just like the sclera, but unlike the sclera, the collagen in the cornea is configured in sheets like a woven mat. And this woven mat is lined up perfectly to allow light to pass through. And in fact, it allows about 99% of light to pass through that structure. The cornea actually has 5 layers, and I know what you're thinking, layers, oh gosh, here's anatomy, gets rough. But there are 5 layers, and they're relatively important, so let me list them out here, and we'll go through them one by one, and hopefully make it not so bad. The most surface layer of the cornea is called the epithelium. And that kind of makes sense. That's not hard to memorize. Epithelium, the entire body is covered by epithelium. Well, so is the cornea, so is the eyeball itself. That epithelium is a very thin layer of cells that can easily scratch off. If you get a piece of sand in your eye and blink, you may roughen up or even scratch off part of that epithelium. And there's a lot of nerve endings in the epithelium, so you really feel it. It hurts a lot, which is good because you want some type of healing response. You want to feel pain with the cornea because you want to blink. People who don't feel corneal pain have a lot of problems with ulcers and infections. Just like diabetics who can't feel things in their feet have a lot of ulcers, there's not that protective pain response when they step on something. Same thing with the eye. The good news, though, is even though the epithelium scratches or rubs off very easily, it heals extremely quickly. And children, young people, a big corneal abrasion can literally heal within 12 to 24 hours. In our older patients or people who have metabolic issues such as diabetes, this healing process is not as quick. And for some people, it's really slow. But for the most part, the cornea, the epithelium, a corneal abrasion heals up quite quickly. So that's the first layer, the epithelium, easy to memorize. The second layer is called the Bowman's membrane. B-O-W-M-A-N-S, Bowman's membrane. It is a densely packed collagen layer, kind of like the rest of the cornea, that is quite strong, but the purpose is unclear. On one level, it creates a bed that the epithelium can stick down to, but there's a lot of animals out there who don't have Bowman's layer, like dogs. And so the entire purpose of the Bowman's layer is a little unclear, but it's thought to help maintain the shape of the eye and to create some type of structure that the epithelium can stick down to. Now, the middle layer of the cornea, which actually takes up most of the corneal thickness itself, is called the stroma. S-T-R-O-M-A, the stroma. It's a collagen layer that's got those weaves, those layers of type 2 collagen that's laid out very nicely. And interspersed with that collagen are keratocytes. They're a type of fibroblast cell that are kind of mixed in and sandwiched in between the sheets. And they're all kind of interconnected, and they produce collagen and keep the cornea healthy and clear. And those keratocytes kick in during inflammation or trauma. But most of the cornea is made of the stroma. And that's that collagen layer that makes up the bulk of it. If you get a laceration or an abrasion that goes through Bowman's layer into the stroma itself, then that's where you get scarring. Things that typically occur over Bowman's layer doesn't cause scar, but if you get deep enough to go into the stroma, you can get scarring. So that's somewhat relevant. The fourth layer is called the decemase membrane. Decemase is a very thin basement membrane made of type 4 collagen, just like all other basement membranes. And it's this layer that the endothelium, which is the next layer, sticks to. If you're thinking to yourself, okay, how am I going to memorize this? Bowman's layer, decemase layer, these are a couple weird doctors' last names these are named after. Here's the mnemonic I use. Decemase is deep, starts with a D, it's deep, while Bowman's layer is high, like up in the Bowery or the Bell Tower. So decemase deep if you want to memorize that. That's how I memorize the layers. And the final layer is the endothelium. The endothelium is a layer of cells on the inside surface of the cornea. And the endothelium, that's easy to remember for one thing. It's endo, just like endothelium you have in blood vessels. Same thing with the cornea, the endothelium. So five layers, and they're not hard to memorize if you just think about, or there's an epithelium on the outside, scratches off, endothelium on the inside, that makes sense, stroma in the middle, and then decemase is deep, Bowman's is up high, five layers. But let's go back to the endothelium because of all the layers, it's maybe the most important one, oddly enough. Now, the endothelium is only a single layer of cells thick. So it's a really thin layer. And these little cells coat the inner surface of the cornea and they're hexagonal shaped. They have six sides to them. They look like a little honeycomb, like a beehive. And the purpose of these endothelial cells is to keep the cornea relatively dry. These little cells work like pump cells, like little bilge pumps, to continuously suck water out of the cornea and pull it back inside the eye. Now, I know what you're thinking now. Like, how can the cornea be dry? What are we talking about here? You would think that the cornea would be wet, if anything. I mean, the outside of the eye is covered by tears all day long, and the inside of the eye is mostly water. You would think the cornea would be wet. Well, the cornea is relatively dry because these endothelial pump cells are continuously sucking water out, and that dryness is extremely important for clarity. Those little collagen fibers that form the cornea have to be lined up just perfectly, and if they get too wet, too boggy, then the structure changes and the cornea becomes cloudy. So the cornea, compared to the sclera, which is white, or the cornea is clear because it's dry, and if the cornea becomes too wet, it turns white, just like the rest of the eyeball. Those bilge pumps are important for a number of reasons, the endothelial bilge pumps, because we're all born with a certain number of these little pump cells, and they don't regenerate. In fact, we're all born with, say, 2,000 or 3,000 of these little cells per square millimeter, and as we age, those cells stop working one by one, which is not a big deal because we normally have so many extra of these cells. It's not a big deal unless we live to 200. But sometimes people lose enough cells that they actually have decompensation of the cornea. It gets too wet and cloudy, requiring a corneal transplant. In fact, you know, in the early days of cataract surgery, they had early phacoemulsification machines that created so much energy that it would kill off all these cells, and it was one of the big reasons why people needed corneal transplants after their cataract surgery. Thankfully, we used viscoelastics and less energy is required, so it's rarely an issue. And some people are born with a condition called Fuchs dystrophy. And with Fuchs, they're born with less of these endothelial pump cells than normal, and so they're at higher risk for their cornea becoming cloudy. And one of the biggest reasons people require corneal transplants these days is Fuchs dystrophy. You just don't have enough endothelial pump cells. You hit 50, 60, and your cornea starts clouding up, and nothing seems to clear it. Fortunately, the surgery for that has dramatically improved. It used to be a full-thickness corneal transplant, but now they can do something called a DSEC, D-S-E-K, which is a partial transplant where they only change out the cornea on the inner layers. And so it's a much less aggressive surgery with a lot less complications. But those are the layers of the cornea. There's five of them, and I belabored the points for a reason. It's something that we look at all the time, and it's quite important. And I know my corneal colleagues will agree with that. We can't talk about the cornea much without discussing, at least in broad detail, the tear film. You know, the tears themselves are quite important because they cover the eye, they cover the cornea especially, and they have several purposes. The tears lubricate the cornea. The tears also create a lubrication surface so that when our eyes close to protect our eyeball, it has something to run over. And the tears themselves actually nourish the cornea. You know, the cornea is a clear structure. There's no blood vessels growing in the cornea except at the edges. There can't be, otherwise it'd block light. And so the cornea, those living cells, those keratocytes, they require nutrition, and they get it from the cornea on the outside and the fluid on the inside of the eye as well. Also, the tear film is actually maybe the most important component of refraction. You know, when light enters the eye, it bends at the cornea. The cornea is kind of like a fixed lens. And it bends on the lens and the inside of the eye as well, but the cornea is where most of that happens. But if you know Snell's law and how light bends when it goes from a less dense medium to a more dense medium. And the change in density from air to the tear film is actually where most of that occurs. And so the tear surface is extremely important for the refraction of light. And people with chronic dry eye will tell you that their vision gets very blurry when they're doing things like reading or driving where they don't blink and the eyes evaporate. So the tear film is pretty crucial. The tears are produced by glands in the conjunctiva and underneath the eyelids, and they're also produced by the lacrimal gland. Now, when I was a student, I assumed the lacrimal gland, well, that must be where the tears come from. Oddly enough, only reflex tearing comes from the lacrimal gland. Most of the tears come from these sort of accessory tear glands, these little tiny glands, and you can't really see them under a microscope, but they're continuously producing tears at a nice basal rate. And then the lacrimal gland kicks in whenever you get sand in your eye or if it's stinging. Tears are removed from the eye by evaporation, and they also drain through the nasal lacrimal system into the nose, which explains why when people have runny eyes, they often have a runny nose as well. We're not going to really cover that today, but the tears are important. The tear film actually has three layers. I don't know what you're thinking, another layer, but here we go. The bottom layer of the tear film is called a mucin layer. This is the layer that sits on the corneal epithelium itself. And this mucin is like mucus produced by goblet cells on the conjunctiva. And it helps the tears stick to the eye and helps spread the tears over the entire surface. Most of the tear layer is the aqueous layer, and that's sort of the watery saline layer that makes up most of the tear film. And there's protein and saline and antibodies, but that's the majority of the tear film is the aqueous. And the surface layer of the tear film is the lipid layer. That lipid is oil produced by meibomian glands that run along the eyelid margin. And these oils cover the surface of the tear film, and it's important to keep tears from evaporating. And the oil is important for creating surface tension so that the tears stay in place and don't run over the lids and run down our cheeks all day long. So three layers, a mucin layer on the bottom, mucus, then a watery aqueous layer, and then an oil layer on top produced by the meibomian glands of the eyelid that keep the tears from evaporating. Let's move on from the cornea and start going inside the eye. The next place I want to talk about is the anterior chamber. This is the fluid-filled space that's located behind the cornea, but still in the front of the iris itself. And it's filled with a fluid called aqueous. Aqueous is important because it maintains the shape of the eye and keeps it nice and inflated. The aqueous also nourishes the avascular cornea and the avascular lens. The lens is another clear structure without blood vessels. So both these living structures need nutrition, and the aqueous is a major component to that. The pressure of the aqueous, how much is produced and how much is drained, is actually responsible for your eye pressure and glaucoma. And the aqueous is also really the only place in the body where we have a window for looking at inflammation. It's like a little aquarium in the front of our eye, and we can actually see white blood cells, macrophages, blood floating in there and diagnose inflammation that you can't see elsewhere, not without taking samples and looking at it under a microscope. So it's a little window into the eye for inflammation, which is important when we start talking about iritis, uveitis, or bleeding inside the eye. The aqueous is produced in the ciliary body, which is behind the iris. We'll talk about that in a second. But the aqueous actually drains out the trabecular meshwork. And the trabecular meshwork is sort of a filter drain located right where the iris inserts on the cornea. So it's actually right where the white of the eye meets the colored part of the eye. That ring all the way around, or right inside there, is the trabecular meshwork, or the angle. And aqueous drains out that angle through the trabecular meshwork into the venous system, which is known as the canal of Schlemm, where the aqueous sort of joins back into our bloodstream. So that's where it drains out through the trabecular meshwork. A little buzzword for you. The next ocular structure is the iris. And the iris, of course, is the colored part of our eye. The iris is a muscular diaphragm. It's kind of like a drum head with a hole in the middle of it, and that hole, that little black spot, is called the pupil. And it looks black because the inside of our eye is dark. There's no light in there, and so the pupil is just a hole right in the middle of the iris. Now, the pupil can change shape dependent upon ambient lighting because the iris, this muscle, can change shape as well. The iris is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, and it actually has two muscles. There is a sphincter-like muscle right along the pupil that constricts, and then there are dilator muscles further out that help dilate the iris. And the sympathetic system controls the dilation part of it. And I guess that makes sense, because if you see a bear in the woods in the middle of the night, your sympathetic fight or flight reflex kicks in, and your pupils dilate. Those dilating muscles pull the pupil open so you can run away and see in the dark. And the parasympathetic system controls constriction, which kind of makes sense too, because when you're resting and digesting and eating food, the sphincter muscles contract, your pupils get very small, which is kind of helpful for focusing close up as well. The drops we use when we dilate our patients in the office work on those two muscles. We use both a sympathomimetic drug to stimulate the retractors, and we use an antiparasympathetic to relax the sphincter muscles. I don't know who came up with this nomenclature, this autonomic stuff, but gosh, I hated it. So anyway, we'll go on. The color of the iris is determined by how much pigment is in the eye, is in the tissue itself. And a lot of that pigment, oddly enough, is located on the back surface of the iris. When I'm doing a cataract surgery, and if I run an instrument to my cataract and accidentally rub or scratch the back of the iris on the lip of the pupil, a lot of brownish pigment is released. Almost looks like dirt or dust that gets kicked up. And so there's a lot of pigment back there. In fact, we occasionally see people who've had a traumatic blunt injury to the eye. Maybe they got punched really hard. And you can sometimes see a almost like an imprint of the pupil edge that's slammed down where the iris rotated back and hit the surface of the lens, and it leaves almost like a dirty footprint. But the point is, there's a lot of pigment on the iris, especially on the back surface. Behind the iris sits the lens, and the lens is a little magnifying glass inside of our eye that allows us to do fine focusing. A lot of people think of the lens as the main focuser of light, like it must do the majority of the refraction of light so that we can see. But it's actually the cornea that does the majority of the bending of light as it enters our eye. The cornea as a fixed lens is very strong and powerful because of that tear-air interface. But the lens does about one-third of the focusing, but it allows us to do a lot of the fine adjustments so that we can see things distance and near. In fact, the human lens can change shape. It can flatten out like a pancake and let us focus on distant objects like a mountain in the distance, or the lens can round out like a marble and allow us to focus on things close up for reading. Not every animal in the animal kingdom works this way. There's a lot of animals out there with lenses just like us, like fish and sharks, but they actually have solid lenses that don't change shape at all. They're not soft like a gummy bear. They're hard like a piece of glass. And they actually rotate forward and backward like a telescope to focus. But that's not how we work. Our lens is flexible. It can change shape and allow us to see those different things. In fact, as we get older, our lens becomes stiffer. We develop early cataracts, crystalline proteins form in there. And that stiffness is actually why we have a harder time focusing. Our focal range narrows away from us, and we need reading glasses to see close up because we can't seem to get our lens to round out as well as we used to. If a lens becomes cloudy, that's what we call a cataract. And a cataract is just a cloudy lens inside the eye. And it occurs because the lens is living tissue. There's cell bodies in there that there's metabolism inside the eye, inside that lens. Even though it looks like a piece of glass, it's not. It's tissue. And the buildup of proteins over time, maybe exacerbated by UV light or oxidation process, who knows, but a buildup of proteins over time creates opacities within the cell bodies that form the lens, and that cloudiness is what we call a cataract, which is what keeps me employed. The lens itself actually has three layers, and even though it looks like a single piece of glass, it actually is more like a peanut M&M. There's three layers. There's an outer layer, like a hard candy shell. That's called the capsule. There's an inner layer, it's kind of like a peanut, that's called a nucleus, which makes sense. And in the middle, there's sort of a soft layer, like a chocolate and a peanut M&M, that's called the cortex, which is relevant because when we do cataract surgery, the way they used to do it was they used to just rip the entire cataract out of the eye in one big piece. But the way we do modern surgery is most cataracts form in the peanut, in the nucleus right in the middle. So what we do is during surgery, I create a small hole in the front of the capsule and the front part of the eye, and go in there, break up the nucleus and the cortex into little pieces and vacuum them out. And what you end up with is the husk of the original cataract. The capsule's still there. And our new implants that we inject in the eye, we inject them inside that husk, inside that little basket. And that's how they sit in there so nicely. So cataract, three layers, a capsule at the outside, nucleus in the middle, cortex. Let's move on. The lens is actually suspended in the eye. It doesn't just float there. It is actually suspended to the ciliary body. The ciliary body is one of those harder things to visualize because you can't really see it directly during a slit lamp exam. It's a ring of muscle that sits immediately behind the iris, and that muscle is attached to the lens itself by little strings, little springs almost. And these little attachments are called zonules. We have hundreds of little zonules holding the lens like a trampoline attached to the ciliary body. That ciliary body has two functions. It can change the shape of the lens by contracting like a sphincter, and as it contracts, the zonular springs, the tension decreases, allowing the lens to become round and stronger, helping us to read. The other purpose of the ciliary body is it produces aqueous. That's where the aqueous fluid that fills up the anterior chamber is produced. Those zonules are relatively delicate. Fortunately, we have a lot of them, but some people, they're genetically weak, such as in Marfan's, where they have this fibrillin issue, and they can have issues where their lens dislocates because the little springs break over time. Those zonules can also break during cataract surgery, causing a lens dislocation, so they're kind of important. They're very hard to see, though, even using a slit lamp microscope. Behind the lens is the majority of the inside of the eye. Now, the eye is mostly hollow back there. Well, I mean, it is hollow back there, but it's not filled with aqueous. It's not filled with saline. It's filled with a clear fluid called the vitreous. And the vitreous is that gel-like fluid that fills up the back of the eye. Children, their vitreous is very, it's almost like gelatinous, like a bowl of jello. And as we get older, that vitreous starts to liquefy a little bit, almost like little pockets of water forming inside of a bowl of jello over time. Debris can precipitate into that gel and cause floaters that people see because they float around in that gel back there casting shadows that you can see. And as we get older, the vitreous gel back there can actually collapse inwards upon itself. It's a sudden event that causes flashes and floaters, and one of the most common things that brings patients into my office on an urgent basis. That's called a PVD, or posterior vitreous detachment. And while it's almost always harmless, occasionally the vitreous, as it's peeling off the retina, can create a little tear or a hole in the retina, and that can be ominous because that can turn into a retinal detachment. There's actually three chambers in the eye. And I know what you're thinking, okay, how can there, three chambers, what are we talking about here? Well, there's the anterior chamber in the front part of the eye. That's in front of the iris, that aquarium up front. There is the vitreous chamber in the back of the eye. That's where all that gel is. But there's actually a little tiny chamber in between them called the posterior chamber. And that posterior chamber is immediately behind the iris, but in front of the lens slash cataract. So there's an anterior chamber in the front. Right behind it, right behind the iris, is a posterior chamber. And then there's the vitreous chamber in the very back. And I know that's really confusing. Anterior, posterior. Why is the posterior in front of the vitreous chamber? It's strange. But that's how it works. And it's relevant because when we do cataract surgery, occasionally we'll have problems and we have to put a lens in the sulcus in the posterior chamber. And they actually call the lenses we use in surgery PCIOLs, or posterior chamber intraocular lenses. So three chambers. This brings us to the retina. The retina is the light-sensing structure in the back of the eye, and if we go back to our camera analogy, it's kind of like the film in a camera. At a macroscopic level, if you look in the eye under a microscope and look back there, we usually do this at the slit lamp microscope using a small 90 diopter lens, and we can even do it with a head-mounted indirect ophthalmoscope. When we look back there, there are some landmarks. One of them, of course, is the optic disc, and that looks like a little circle, and that's the insertion of the optic nerve entering the back of the retina, kind of like a pipe coming into the back of a wall. The macula is the pigmented area that's responsible for our central vision, which is really a big deal for people with macular degeneration because that's central vision gets knocked out. The fovea is the exact middle of the macula. So that's like our fine, extreme central vision. If you're reading a book and you're looking at a word, you're looking at that word with your macula. But if you're looking at the period at the end of the sentence, that period is at the fovea. So fovea is the extreme middle of the retina itself. There's another term called the foveola, which is an anatomic pit right in the middle of the fovea. It's more of an anatomic term, not really a clinical one. I never say my patient's got a slightly pigmented foveola. It's such a fine detail. But if you actually do a scan using an OCT or even do histology, the foveola is where the surface of the retina dips down and then comes back up again, right smack in the middle of the fovea, right in the middle of the macula. So foveola is another term. But we mainly talk about the macula and the fovea on a day-to-day basis. The retina is plastered against the inside of the eye, almost like wallpaper, and it comes forward towards the ciliary body and stops at a place called the ora serrata, O-R-A. I believe that's spelled S-E-R-A-T-A. So it's like a serrated edge or scallop pattern. If you look at it under a microscope, which is pretty hard actually because it's around a corner, it actually has sort of a scalloped, irregular appearance to where it's firmly attached. But the retina is firmly attached there. And people with retinal detachments, a lot of times the retina will peel off like wallpaper, but it still sticks to the ora serrata because it's firmly adherent there. And it still sticks to the optic nerve because that's another place where it's firmly adherent. So you'll see almost like a curtain coming down from those two spots when we do an ultrasound. So the ora serrata. At a microscopic level, the retina itself has many layers. And this is the one area of eye anatomy that as a medical student gave me fits. I hated it. Retinal anatomy, or you want to just shoot me. It's terrible. There's all these layers. There's inner plexiform, outer nuclear, bipolar layers, amacrine, horizontal cells, Mueller processes. These things really stressed me out because I thought this must be super important. I spent a lot of time trying to memorize these layers. And then I became a resident and no one ever asked me again because they're not really that important for clinical eye care. They're very important for learning about macular degeneration and for eye scientists. But there's only a couple layers that really matter. And the most important layer, of course, is the photoreceptor layer. The photoreceptors are those cells in the retina that actually detect light. And there's rods and cones. Rods detect black and white light, essentially. They're highly sensitive, and we have a whole bunch of them. And cones are more important for our color vision. There's three different types of cones, and they detect color. Our central vision has a lot of cones, and our peripheral vision has a lot of rods. The rods are better at night vision, so if you notice at night your color vision stinks, that's why, but the cones are really good for bright light and fine detail. Now the photoreceptors, if you were thinking like if you were to design a retina or design a camera, where would you put the photoreceptors? Would you put them on the surface of the retina so that light hits them immediately? Well, that's what I would do, but that's not actually how they're arranged. The photoreceptors are actually the bottommost layer of the retina, which is really weird. That means when light enters the eye and hits the retina, it actually has to travel through all these other layers to even get to the photoreceptors to be detected at the very bottom. So the light has to go through some surface ganglion nerves, and that's actually the only other layer of the retina you really need to care about. There's actually a surface layer of cells that run along the surface of the retina called the ganglion nerves. And basically, light goes through those ganglion nerves, through a bunch of intermediate cells, and finally hits the photoreceptors at the bottom, the rods and cones. And then it gets turned into a signal and gets shot back up the retina to the surface, to those ganglion nerves. And then the signal travels over the surface of the retina on its way to the optic nerve before that nerve dives down into the optic nerve, eventually into the brain. So it's a really bizarre setup, but we'll come back to why it's done that way in just a moment. But just realize, many layers of the retina, but the photoreceptors on the bottom for some reason, and the signal, the ganglion nerves that actually send the signals, runs along the surface of the retina. Now, the retina is a very metabolically active structure. It's always working. You're always detecting light. Even when your eyes are closed in the middle of the night, light's getting through your eyelids. And so it's like the heart. It's always beating. The eye is always working. The eye, unfortunately, just like the heart, doesn't have a lot of collateral blood supply. And most of the surface layers of the retina, those ganglion nerves, get their blood from the central retinal artery. That's a big artery that comes right in the middle of the optic nerve. And when you look inside the eye, you can see it because it's branching out and it has that sort of blood vessel appearance to it. And that basically gives oxygen and nutrition to those surface layers. The waste products go out the central retinal vein, so it goes back out the optic nerve. And you can see the vein, and the vein looks bigger and it looks darker. So the central retinal artery and the central retinal vein. But you know what? That's not the whole story because the photoreceptors, those so important, those rods and cones, they don't actually get their nutrition from that blood vessel like you'd expect. In fact, the rods and cones, they get their nutrition from the choroid. And the choroid is a bed of blood vessels that underlies the entire retina. So the entire, there's a big nexus, a big bed of blood vessels back there called the choroid. And it's immediately under the retina. And the photoreceptors get their nutrition through, kind of percolates up through the choroid up to the photoreceptors. Waste products get pumped back down to it. And so the choroid is kind of a big deal. So you can have a central retinal artery occlusion, completely block off that artery to the eye, and it'll kill off a lot of your cells, your surface nerve cells, your intermediate cells. But the photoreceptors are probably okay. Unfortunately, they can't get their signal to the brain, but they're still there. So it's the choroid that supplies most of the photoreceptors. So it's a deep layer, rich blood supply back there. In fact, it's such a rich blood supply back there, it's almost like a grid of blood vessels. And a lot of metastases can sometimes be detected. Melanomas tend to land in the choroid. Lymphomas can land in the choroid. And so I'm occasionally asked to rule out any eye metastases. So we'll dilate and look back there and see if we see any masses that look like they're underneath the retina, bulging the retina forward. Now, we're almost done with the retina, but there are a couple more intermediate layers. In between the retina and the underlying choroid is a layer of cells called the RPE. This is the retinal pigment epithelium. This is a single cell layer thick layer of cells whose purpose is manyfold. One of them is that it's pigmented. It's a pigmented layer. And what that does is it absorbs photons. So when light goes through the retina, which is mostly clear, through all those layers and finally hits the photoreceptors, it keeps going. And you don't want it bouncing around in the eye, so you want it to get stopped. So the RPE is a pigmented layer that keeps aberrant light from bouncing around. The RPE is also important because it's part of the blood-retina barrier between the choroid and the retina. And it's mostly important, though, for metabolism for the rods and cones. The rods and cones create a lot of waste products, and that stuff needs to get transported into the choroid and vice versa. And so the RPE facilitates that. The pigmented layer is so pigmented that occasionally someone will have a retinal detachment. And with a retinal detachment, you actually get a tear or a hole in the retina itself. And pigment from the RPE layer can come through that little tear into the vitreous jelly that makes up the inside of the eye. And I can actually see pigment floating behind the lens inside the eye. This is called a Schaefer sign. And one of the things we look for when we're looking for retinal detachments is, do they have a Schaefer sign? Because if they do, that implies there must be a break somewhere. It sounds like a really useful sign. It's not that useful, but it is one of those pertinent negatives that we tend to document. There is one final layer called the Bruch's membrane. Bruch's membrane is a little elastic layer that sits right underneath the RPE cells, right on top of the choroid. Normally, this is such a small layer, I wouldn't bother talking about it because we can start going ad nauseum on this, but it is kind of important for one reason. Fat deposits can sometimes form in it, and little fatty lipofuscin buildup forms in Bruch's membrane, and this causes macular degeneration. With macular degeneration, this buildup forms here, and it slows down the transport of nutrition and waste from the photoreceptors and the choroid because of those little fatty lipofuscin buildups. They're called drusen. They look like little yellow spots when you look at them under the microscope. The retina overlying these drusen can sometimes atrophy, and that's what we call dry macular degeneration. It's just the photoreceptors, and they just can't get enough oxygen, and so they just sort of slowly atrophy and die off. In fact, Bruch's membrane can become so irregular that you actually form little breaks. It kind of breaks apart. And when that happens, blood vessels from the choroid can grow up through Bruch's membrane into the retina itself and start to bleed. And that is a big deal. And that's what we call wet macular degeneration. And when I say wet, they really mean bloody, because there's bleeding. And bleeding in the retina is never good because it causes scarring, sudden acute vision loss, and it used to be very hard to treat. And still, it's not that easy to treat, and it tends to be a major cause of vision loss in developed countries. Finally, there's the optic nerve. The optic nerve is that big nerve in the back of the eye that sends the signals from the eye to the brain. And the optic nerve actually starts with the ganglion nerves. Those are those nerves that I was talking about that run along the surface of the retina. They're like a sheet, and that sheet of nerves travels to a single spot, the optic nerve, and those nerves dive down into the optic nerve and eventually synapse in the lateral geniculate nucleus in the brain. And you can almost think of the optic nerve kind of like a pipe. It's like a PVC pipe coming in the back of our eye, and there's about 1.2 million wires running through that pipe. Well, there's actually anatomically something we call a disc and a cup. And a disc is the outer edge of the optic nerve as we can see it inside the eye. And the cup is a little indent right in the middle of that disc. And it makes sense because if wires are running down into a pipe, then there's going to be a little gap in the middle where the wires aren't at yet. And the cup-to-disc ratio is something that we examine and is very important when we're talking about glaucoma. Because with glaucoma, those nerve fibers die off. High pressure kills them off slowly over time. It's like pulling wires out of our pipe, and so you end up getting a larger and larger hollow spot right in the middle of your optic nerve. So the cup-to-disc ratio is something that we always comment on during a dilated eye exam. To summarize what we've talked about so far, let's do a thought experiment. How does light enter the eye and get sent back to the brain? And we'll go through each of the structures we've already talked about and make sure that we're on the same page. So basically, light enters the eye. The first thing it does is it hits the tear film. As we remember, three layers of the tear film, There's that surface oil layer, keeps it from evaporating, the aqueous layer that's most of the tears, and that mucus layer right on the surface. So the water, the light goes through the tear film. It then hits the cornea. And how many layers are there in the cornea? There's 5 layers. The outer one's the epithelium. The inner one is the endothelial pump layer. Most of the middle part is the stroma. That's the main corneal thickness. And of course, there's those 2 extra layers, Bowman's on top, decimase underneath. The light then travels into the anterior chamber, which is that fluid-filled pocket in front of the iris, but still inside the eye. The light travels through the iris pupil into that small posterior chamber, that potential space back there, and immediately through the lens. And as remember, the lens can change shape and has 3 layers like a peanut M&M. It has a capsule, a cortex, and a nucleus. After going through the lens, the light travels through the vitreous gel that fills up the back part of the eye in that vitreous chamber, and then strikes the retina, preferably at the macula because that's your fine central vision. Now, when light strikes the retina, it has to go through the surface ganglion nerves first. It goes through a bunch of retinal layers that aren't important to us right now to finally strike the rods and cone photoreceptors at the bottom layer of the retina. Here, the signal gets turned into an electrical signal that shoots back up the retina to the surface ganglion nerves, and that signal travels along the surface of the retina towards the optic disc and then plunges down over the edge of the disc into the optic nerve itself. Here, the signal is sent back to the brain, to the lateral geniculate nucleus, through some optic radiations, eventually to the occipital lobe in the back of the brain. Now, the brain component to the visual pathway, I'll leave for future a neurology lecture, but that's pretty much the anatomy of the eye itself. And I can see the time's running low, so I'm not going to talk about all that external anatomy, but I think that's enough for one sitting. Before we go, though, I'd like to answer a couple of anatomy questions that people have posed to me in the past, because I think sometimes the Socratic method and answering questions is a really good way to sort of focus our mental powers. The first one is Dewa's layer. Recently, on the internet, there's a lot of press releases about a 6th layer in the cornea. It's called Dewa's layer, D-U-A, named after Professor Dewa, and is based on a paper he published in 2013. The big question, of course, is this truly a layer in the eye, and is there any significance to you as an eye student? Not really, other than the fact that you should know about it. When I first heard about Dewa's layer, it was one of those moments where you kind of roll your eyes. You know, like, oh my gosh, if someone's trying to name another layer after themselves. Are you kidding me? It's basically a layer that's supposed to be sandwiched in between the decimase membrane and the stroma itself. And every cornea doctor I've asked about this seems to be either underwhelmed or shrug their shoulders or somewhat ambivalent about this as a layer, and will it have any significance to future corneal transplant surgery or perhaps significance with keratoconus or some other disease processes. So is this truly a layer? I have no idea. Does it have any relevance to clinical eye care? Once again, I don't know, and I don't mean to poo-poo it too much. I suppose we get set in our ways, and I hate to learn more anatomy after spending so much time learning it. But it was one of those moments in your life, kind of like when they told you that Pluto was no longer a planet. You're like, what? Are you kidding me? Like, Pluto is loved and revered by a lot of people. Same thing with my eye anatomy. So we'll see if Dewa's layer ends up being a true layer or not. Will it stick as a ophthalmology finding? You know, there's a tendency, I think, for all of us in the medical field to attempt to name things after themselves so you can go down in history. We're always trying to rename surgical instruments and parts of the eye, signs in the body, such as Murphy's sign, and certainly cataract surgeons are prone to this as well. We're constantly trying to invent new ways to break up cataracts and then name them after ourselves. So there's the horizontal chop, choo-choo chop, the root chop, and of course, we're always writing books and trying to name them after ourselves as well. I don't know if you've read it yet, but Root Eye Dictionary, the most interesting and entertaining eye dictionary ever written in the history of medicine ever. Okay, I'll move on. Next question, uvea. What is the uvea? That's U-V-E-A. What is that? Well, the uvea is an anatomic term, and I haven't brought it up yet because I didn't want to confuse you, but the uvea is very important. The uvea is made up of 3 structures we've already described. It's made up of the iris, the ciliary body muscle, and the choroid blood supply. All 3 of these layers are pigmented and they're all kind of connected and embryologically related. So the uvea is these three layers. The significance is that the uvea is the place in the eye that tends to become inflamed when you have inflammatory conditions or infections. In fact, it's so important that there's a whole subspecialty of ophthalmology called uveitis specialists. There's not many of them because there's not enough uveitis out there to support someone in a normal private practice, but certainly uveitis is something important and you should know a lot about. When we're talking about inflammation in the front part of the eye, we're usually talking about an anterior uveitis, and that usually means an inflammation of the iris or of the ciliary body, or usually both. And we usually call that a anterior uveitis, or more commonly an iritis. But so if you get punched in the eye and you have sensitivity to light, that's because you have an inflamed iris, you have an iritis or an anterior uveitis. There are a lot of conditions that can cause a uveitis, such as inflammatory issues like ankylosing spondylitis and other HLA-B27 related disorders. There's infectious causes such as tuberculosis, syphilis, toxoplasmosis, inflammatory conditions like sarcoidosis. So there's a lot of stuff that can cause uveitis, and it's such a subspecialty that it's a whole field in and of itself. A posterior uveitis would mainly just be the choroid back there, and that's something a retina doctor would know more about. So the uvea is the iris, the ciliary body, and the choroid. Kind of important. Well, I think that about wraps things up, folks. As I promised at the beginning of this lecture, we're concentrating mainly on the internal eye anatomy today, and I didn't cover the other topics like the orbit, eyelids, or eye muscles. I think we'll save those for future talks as they become relevant, and I hope you found this episode useful. The show notes can be found at italkradio.com, or you can also go to ibasics101.com and just look for episode 2. And until next time, thanks for listening.
Dr. Root would like to remind you that this program has been created for educational purposes. The opinions stated here should not be considered medical advice, and this information is not intended to replace a direct consultation with a medical doctor. If you have an eye problem, please consult with an eye doctor to accurately diagnose your condition and tailor a treatment specific for you.